Hello, and welcome to episode 137 of the Omni Gamers Club podcast, the podcast where we discuss all manner of games on all platforms, including claw machines, real or virtual. My name is Mark Uasa, and we're joined by...
And I am Daniel Winter. Hello, Mark. How are you?
I am well. It's the relaxing family day weekend here in BC anyway. Family day. It's a new holiday that they made up a few years back. Unfortunately, last year they didn't have it as a stat holiday in Ontario, so I had to work it. But this time around, I do get the day off. So looking forward to that tomorrow. How about yourself?
Yes, my wife also works for a Toronto-based company, so did not get that off last year, but fortunately got the full weekend here this weekend. We've got Valentine's and my wife's birthday all rolled into one, so fairly busy. But today, actually, I had a friend's daughter had a birthday party where they went to a claw machine parlor, and it's a unique one in that it's basically play till you win, or you play a flat rate, and you just keep getting tokens until you win the prize. the prize class size that you paid for, basically. So we had been there before, which was good fun, but my daughter got like 12 prizes today, and then at the end you choose the one that you want to keep. But it's a good fun to just like play with the mechanics of the claw machine outside of the gambling aspect.
Nice. Actually, maybe you can train up to be extra at the claw machine when it really counts. Now, that's a really cool idea. You're going to have to share with me where that was. That sounds cool.
Yeah, I'm hoping it sort of burns her out of the gambling aspect rather than just creates an addict. So we'll see.
I don't know. The pull of the claw machine is pretty addictive, or the UFO catcher, as they call it in Japan and other places. All right. So we are having a regular episode here where we're going to do actually, it might be slightly different than usual. We're going to do our dessert topic, which is just a brief little intro. Sorry, appetizer, I should say. Then we're going to do our main course, which is a smattering of games from the same series today.
We've been promising for some time.
Yes. And to finish it off, we're going to have dessert. So some off-topic topics not related to games there. So that's our format. Daniel, you want to start us off?
Yeah. So jumping into the appetizer, I have a quick update from last week's episode where I talked about Get Lamp, the text adventure documentary. And curiously, that documentary pointed to a competition called IF Cop as sort of the future of the genre, where each year there was basically submissions to all relatively short text adventures that were then grouped and judged on this yearly annual basis, and it was a way to sort of build excitement for the genre. And another comparison I had made was in text adventures with some of the way that people were talking about how you pass and talk to the computer, having some similarities to the way people now talk about AI. So I saw an article this week. I'll drop the link in the show notes, but it was from Mimi Dashima. And it was pointing out that, I mean, as you can expect, the interactive fiction community has not been immune to the charm of AI. Apparently, there had been various entries in the last few years that were starting to bloat out that the IF comp specifically. There'd been some concerns in that documentary, apparently, even in 2010, when that documentary came out, that people were using these sort of competitions as a sort of a low-effort way to get your game in front of eyes, that like you can guarantee people will check out your game or playtest your game for you without putting any effort in. Seems like that had somewhat escalated in the era of AI. And as of 2026, the IF Comp organizers have now banned AI, which I thought was a good sign, obviously. There was some interesting surveys and commentary on like how it's not just brings the quality of the competition down, but it sort of scares away new members when it's already a very niche community. So that article from Mimi Dashima sort of broke down some of her own thoughts, and it was an interesting context from someone outside of that community, so worth checking out. And I also got some recommendations from some newer text adventures to check out myself, so I'll be taking a look at those.
Very cool. Yeah, I would like to take a look at the current state of IF games, because it has been a few years since I looked at them regularly for my previous podcast. There were some really clever ones, and I think I would really enjoy running you through one or two of those. You know, a lot of them are quite short, and maybe we can do that as a special episode. Maybe have you, maybe Dennis, come on board as a co-panelist to help be the player in a virtual game where I could GM. I would like to do that a lot. Another type of interactive fiction game, which we didn't really talk about but is very useful, is related to a title I have next to me here, so I'm going to show it in a second. But do you know about adventure game books?
I mean, there's like Choose Your Own Adventure games, certainly. I read all those Goosebumps novels back in the day.
Yeah, Choose Your Own Adventure games are... I think would classify as interactive fiction because, of course, there's not just one ending. You can sort of morph and see which direction you want to go at. I think adventure game books are slightly more advanced than those even, in that these have things like character sheets. They have things like encounters, enemies. You might even roll dice. You might even use pencil to mark down stat changes or hit point damage, things like that, items that you accrue. These are basically specifically single-player role-playing adventures that come out of a book with no GM intended or provided, because the book provides all the sort of direction that's intended, and you as the sole reader are the sole player, and they're always designed to be that way. And I know that they were a popular phenomenon in the 80s when I was growing up.
It's like the Fighting Fantasy, I think it's called, was a popular series.
Yeah, Fighting Fantasy, and I think maybe Sorcery is another popular series. But I just wanted to show off a new crowdfunding product that I got, which is this one, which features the name Fighting Fantasy. This one is Fighting Fantasy Adventures. And this is based off of a game book series of the same name, Fighting Fantasy. And this one, in this case, is a reinterpretation of those game books in basically like solo card game form. So I don't know if it's very clear off of the back of the book here, but instead of a book, you get these cards that have prompts. You get cards that act as equipment, and you have tokens. So this is making an adventure game book into more of a solo board game
product. Is it still a solo experience?
It is a solo experience, I believe, although it may support more than one player. But they were always intended to be solo products to begin with. And interesting enough, another board game connection is that this game, which is officially licensed Fighting Fantasy product, has also been adapted by Steve Jackson and Ian Livingstone, I think was the original author. And the game design of this new format is by noted board game designer Martin Wallace.
Oh,
okay. Who's done plenty of board games and war games in the past of note.
And
so,
can you look somewhere behind me here?
Yeah. So I have yet to crack open the seal on that, but I'm excited to try it out because you mentioned interactive fiction.
Very cool. I'm definitely curious to check that out. I should see if the library has any of the classic Fighting Fantasy books. I'm not sure how replayable those are.
I think they are. Like, I think, you know, there's not a legacy aspect of it where maybe you draw in the book a little bit, but you probably don't scribble anything out.
Okay, a couple of other quick bits of news. There's an itch.io bundle right now called No Ice in Minnesota. I'm sure you can guess what that is in aid of. But it's one of these bundles that has like 1,500, it's a couple of video games, largely TTRPG zines that I had a look through. I mean, it was a pretty easy buy for me, both in terms of value and for a good cause, obviously. So I've been breezing through that. I haven't had time to read any yet, but I've loaded up my tablet with a bunch of zines to read through. One that I'm particularly keen to read is Axolotl with a Gun. They've got a second edition of that right now on as part of Zine Month, which I still haven't had time to really dig into. I'm hoping to make some time to discuss that on an upcoming episode before the end of the month.
Yeah, I forget exactly which of the titles are included in that, but there are quite a few notable TTRPGs in that bundle in PDF form. I think there's a few Powered by the Apocalypse ones, and there are quite a few pre-written adventures for Mothership.
I saw that, yeah.
Which is a title that we've talked about quite a bit. And I think there are even some for Fist, which is another TTRPG I'm very interested in.
Mandelbrot Set is one that I was particularly interested in, which is uses the Fist system.
Yeah. Fist, we should talk about at some point, because I have the PDF for that, and I've read it, and it's very, very interesting from a sort of a schlocky, like, 80s action movie sort of perspective. I might even have mentioned it on an early episode, but I've never gotten the chance to play it, so I really would like to try. But suffice it to say, I think that bundle is a really good value. I haven't taken the bite of it because I actually own a lot of the games that are included in the bundle, but if you haven't purchased previous itch.io TTRPG bundles, like, what are you waiting for? There's some great titles in there.
I saw there's already a few people who have catalogued some of the offerings in there and sort of broken down them into smaller categories so you can filter a little easier, perhaps. So, yeah, I'll try and find one of those things as well to drop in the show notes.
Yeah, with thousands of games, it's a little hard to find the exact games that might interest you, but trust me, there's plenty of good ones in there.
I was reminded that one of the older itch.io bundles I bought years ago and started digging through that and found like five games that I've been wanting to try. Like, oh, I already have that, I guess. So
there you go.
Very okay, cool. Final bit of news. This last week we had the PlayStation State of Play, something that I am generally not particularly interested in since I don't actively use a PlayStation right now. I did really enjoy those back in the day. I remember for a couple of years, they used to like stream them at our local cinema. This was like when they had the big, you know, Last of Us, in the barn, they were big multimedia experiences. So that was fun when I was more involved in the sort of PlayStation ecosystem. But seeing some news pop out around this, I decided to check it out anyway. And there was a couple of really interesting news tidbits. First of all, Kena: Bridge of Spirits, a game I covered a few months ago, is getting a sequel. What was that? Scars of Cosmoro. So that was a sort of 3D action platformer game that I found have a lot of heart, be a little flawed, but it's really interesting to see this sort of budget level game, sort of B-grade game. Doesn't often, like, not many of these games are made these days, and when they are, they very rarely get a chance to sort of polish off and expand their ideas and take another shot at it. So really curious to see how they work upon that. It looks like a much bigger, richer world, a lot more characters. You ride around in a cute fox critter. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to have the little soot sprites that you used to put hats on in the original game, so that's a little disappointing, I guess, but I'm sure they'll have something to replace that with. Looking forward to that.
Maybe they got some copyright strikes from Studio Ghibli, perhaps.
Well, that was one of my takeaways. It was riffing a little too closely on Ghibli, I think. But it was really beautiful animation, at the very least. A couple of other updates. On a recent episode, I talked in detail about the Castlevania series that I've been working through, which we have not seen a new game in that series since 2014, Lords of Shadows 2. So what's that, 12 years now? And that same episode, you were talking about Legacy of Kain remaster, which has not seen a new game in 23 years. 2003 was the last game in that series. Well, in this PlayStation State of Play, they've announced new games in both those series. So they're rising back from the dead, undead vampires, I guess, as it were. Castlevania: Belmont's Curse is coming out by Evil Empire. That is the studio responsible for Dead Cells, who did previously have an official Castlevania tie-in DLC. I played the base game, but not the Castlevania series. But this looks really cool. It's a classic 2D Castlevania, really crisp 2D animation, some really stunning visuals that has me quite excited to check that out.
Yeah, that phenomenon of kind of junior, smaller studios being given the keys to the castle of larger, more legendary series is a real phenomenon that's picked up lately. I mean, they've even done, particularly Konami, who you're mentioning owns Castlevania, even licensed the property to Vampire Survivors. Right? Nice. If you recall that there's an expansion there. And I think there's going to be a title that I'm going to mention later that's from a kind of a smaller company that got a tryout and got to produce a bigger game of their own. So yeah, everything old is new again. I mean, I kind of feel like this is like 10 years ago in like the movie cinema space where everything was a sequel. I guess that's the last 30 years if you really want to say it. But everything is a sequel. All these old properties are coming back. And it's nice to see Konami coming back, certainly. They used to be a real force. They went silent after MGS5. And then it looks like they're tentatively trying to come back to original games.
I'm busy with those pachinko machines, I hear.
Pachinko machines and exercise parlors or something like that. Who knows?
Yeah, to clarify, though, the Legacy of Kain Ascendance is the new game. I believe that is coming from Crystal Dynamics, the original developer of that series. But another one, following the trend you were discussing, is there's a new 2D God of War game. It's already out. It was like a shadow drop. I believe that was... I can't remember the name of the studio, but it was in collaboration with Santa Monica, and a smaller studio had taken over that to give a new spin on a 2D God of War.
Yeah, I think it's really good when older series kind of get too large and too ungainly. They haven't seen the light of day recently. It's nice that these publishers are willing to kind of like loosen their belts a little bit and try something. Try something kind of lower budget, lower stakes with a smaller developer who's cutting their teeth and giving them a chance to shine. I think that's good all around. Maybe it's not the ultimate sign of health for a games industry that's troubled with too much bloat and too much money, financial control. But it among the potential trends that are out there, it's not the worst.
These series can get trapped in the sort of expectations of AAA, you know, budgets and expectations, and letting them escape containment and breathe a little more with a different studio and a different set of expectations, I guess, is healthy.
Give those younger studios a chance to, well, give them a paycheck for one, and yeah, then give them a chance to flourish and then kind of gain their own wings and hopefully produce bigger, more exciting stuff later on.
Absolutely.
All right. Talking about bigger stuff, shall we talk about our main course?
Sure thing. Let's jump into that.
We got a lot of games to cover here. I don't know if we've mentioned it yet, but we teased it in previous episodes, maybe last week, maybe the week before that, but... We definitely did the week before that, because you were talking about Metroidvanias, I think. And you originally let slip that, really, if you think about it, why aren't Zelda games Metroidvania games? Well, maybe they are. We're going to determine that once and for all in this discussion of Zelda games. We're not going to cover them all. How could we? We don't have time for that. But I'm going to talk about at least two entries that I played recently, and I'll probably chime in on some of the older titles that you're going to mention.
Yeah, I mean, we've previously covered Tears of the Kingdom in detail. I don't know if we reviewed Breath of the Wild. Maybe that was, I guess that was probably before the podcast. But I mean, what's your history with the series, first of all?
My history is pretty uneven. I feel like I played every other Zelda. I mean, I was around at the time where Zelda was like first coming out. I didn't play number one. I didn't play number two. I think the first one I got around to was... A Link to the Past on SNES, Super Nintendo. Didn't finish that one, but there was a lot of charm in that one. That one is just kind of like the platonic ideal, I think, in terms of 2D graphical versions of that type of game. I really enjoy. I think the first Zelda game that I finished was Ocarina of Time on the N64. Absolutely legendary title, which I think is one of the best games I've ever played and finished. And it's great. I bought the remake of that on 3DS, also very good. And I've played a smattering of the 3D titles, including Wind Waker, skipped a few, and then I've played the modern ones. I played a smattering of the handheld ones as well. There's a few for the Game Boy, some of which we'll be talking about. And there's been a couple of 2D entries for the Switch. Even the DS had an entry, if I'm not mistaken. I played a smattering of a bunch of them, let's just say.
Sure. Yeah, so Ocarina of Time was my first Zelda game. When was that? 98. I would have been 10 years old, which seems pretty perfect time for that. And I think Link's Awakening, the DX Color version, came out that same year, and I had my Game Boy Color, so I was playing both of those pretty much simultaneously. From then on, I've basically played all of the mainline sort of the 3D main console games. I'd skipped a bunch of the handhelds because I didn't really have the Game Boy Advance or DS for a while. I did play some of the later, like, Link Between Worlds, I think, was the more recent one. I've played a couple of those, and obviously up through Tears of the Kingdom. But yeah, this last few months, having played Metroid and Castlevania, put me in mind that I really should double back to the roots of Zelda. So I've been playing through from the original Legend of Zelda, but I'm now back up to Ocarina of Time, which I'm actually playing alongside my daughter. She's playing, like, we're sort of tag teaming it. She's been playing a bit, and it's really curious to see, watch it through her eyes. And it's so hard for me to judge it objectively at this point and not through nostalgic lenses, so seeing how she approaches it has been a really interesting perspective. But yeah, I guess we'll jump quickly to the beginning. I'll just breeze through some of these. Legend of Zelda 1986 on the NES, you know, which is pretty close to its launch, basically. And I mean, I was surprised just how much of the touchstones are there from the get-go. Some of the items that you're using, the enemies are all quite, like, considering, like, we played Final Fantasy, the first one of those, which had really generic looking monsters. This has quite creative monsters from the get-go. Some of the classic Ikes, and I don't remember a lot of the names, but a lot of distinctive creatures, and it's some really interesting verticality, like they're sort of jumping out of the screen, or at least the illusion they're doing so. So it was surprisingly creative. It had the eight dungeons, obviously, so it has the broad structure. The sense of direction wasn't quite there. It's basically just explore this world. You'll, I guess, eventually come across these dungeons. It wasn't really guiding you in a meaningful way. There was no real story in game. It was just work your way through there. I did find it very combat heavy. These first few games were all surprisingly heavy on combat rather than puzzles. What puzzles were there were, like, largely just almost pixel hunting, just like burn every bush, like bomb every wall. Eventually you'll find some secret by trial and error. Largely there wasn't much intuition in finding those secrets.
Yeah, a lot of those early adventure games were really just exploration games, you know? Like, let's have a map. And this was a map that you could literally plan out on a big poster board or large sheets. Graph paper. And that's probably largely what the initial developers did back in the day. And now that I think about it, I mean, there's a lot of similarities between, like, the first Zelda and the first Zork game. Like, basically, every screen was a discrete area. You walked to the edge of the screen and then you moved to the next screen. And that's very much what happens in Zork. You move north and then you go to the panel that's further north of that. And I think that was, like, the extent of adventure games, or the expectations of those back in the day, is that you seek the key, you know? You seek the key to open the door that's blocking you. It really doesn't need to be more complex than that. And definitely the first Zelda had that to a T. I agree that the monster designs for the Zelda games have always been iconic and quite cool. I disagree that the Final Fantasy monster designs were generic. I think they're lovingly crafted by Yoshitaka Amano in the original.
I don't mean the designs, I just mean, like, you're fighting wolves and goblins, right?
Yeah, well, you're fighting a lot of D&D inspired, literally, yeah. D&D inspired creatures like mummies and sahagins and things like that, which they ripped straight from the Dungeon Master's Guide. So yeah, every series shows its inspiration. But yeah, Legend of Zelda 1, absolutely iconic. Never finished it, but the statement is still true. You know, take this, it's dangerous to go alone when you grab that sword for the first time. It's epic and iconic for a reason.
Strangely, that world is just full of old people, like, hiding in caves that will give you hints. There's one I found that basically tells you, oh, go and look behind the waterfall. And as far as I can tell, that is the first instance of a secret behind a waterfall. It's like, obviously, we know to think to check that. But, I mean, if you're trying to consider this when it came out, it's almost something of a Metroid brainier, you might say. Like, unlocking the knowledge of where you need to look. Some of the areas of the map are gated by items, but a lot of it, you need to know where to look and where to poke and where to bomb, and you'll unlock sort of secrets and hints as you explore.
Yeah, I think hints and secrets like that have always been especially back in that generation, pretty critical. I mean, this is the thing you would talk about at the playground on the next weekday after you'd been playing the game nonstop all over the weekend, because we didn't have the internet. We only had word of mouth. And 3/4 of that information you would hear whispered at the playground would be total BS, of course, but 1/4 of it would be useful information. In that sense, Zelda shares a similar quality with that mainline staple Nintendo series Super Mario Brothers of having little secret hidden areas that you can find by pixel hunting, like you said, going off the screen at a given point and finding shortcuts and hidden items or extra rupees in this case instead of coins.
Yeah. The most frustrating part of this was just the grindiness of those rupees of health. Like Metroid, even when you increase your maximum number of hearts, when you spawn, you still only have 3 hearts, and you have to go kill a bunch of enemies to like grind hearts a bit more. And the rupee economy, like a lot of things required 250 rupees, and like you're really grinding out 1 rupee at a time. So it's a little grindy. So I found that a little frustrating, but all in all, it holds up surprisingly well at first game.
The thing that really gets me to this day, which I'm so mad about, is the artificial wallet size restraint of those Zelda games. I think that's a terrible game mechanic that says, nope, once you're at 100 rupees, you can't collect any more. There's no possible way you could hold any more. I suppose it sort of makes sense if you're talking about gold coins or physical gems. Maybe your pockets will only contain so much. So maybe that's part of it, but it always...
Maybe the system just couldn't process a number bigger than 99. I don't know.
But you could collect that if you got this unlocked equipment or something like that. Anyways, there's a lot of classic elements there. Tell me about Zelda 2, actually, because that's a title I don't have a lot of background
in. So this is the real black sheep of the family. It basically is everyone thinks of it as a 2D side scroller, but curiously, it's actually just as much an isometric adventure game, similar to Gargoyle's Quest that you discussed, where like you're exploring the map on a top-down isometric perspective, and then when you go into a dungeon, it cuts to a 2D action platformer.
Well, this won't be the last Zelda game that does have 2D side-scrolling elements in it, as we'll discuss later on.
Well, even that first game did have a little bit in some dungeons, but only minimally, yeah.
Yeah, it's really funny how Zelda, especially the 2D ones, sort of just like cheesed top-down and side-scrolling, because quite often they'll use the same sprites, because if you're walking sideways on a top-down screen and you're walking sideways on a side-scrolling screen, it's the same pixel art. Really, really clever reuse of design elements there. I guess they just tweaked with the gravity to make sure that if you jump, you fall down. And in some of the later Zeldas, I do really find it annoying to do platforming, jumping over
pits. It's not designed for that, right?
From a top-down perspective. It's literally not designed for that, as you say. But anyways, getting ahead of ourselves. What else is unique or interesting about Zelda 2?
Yeah, I mean, the combat also quite tough in that. But I did really appreciate there's a lot of like positional directions that are important when you're fighting enemies. Like they'll have their shields and they'll either hold them down below or hold them up high. And you need to like stab your sword high or low and like be very reactionary to the enemies. So it was quite responsive in that way. I found it did get a little spammy towards the end where the enemies are like rapidly fluctuating between these two states and you just have to spam your way through to win. But at least at the start, it's quite interesting how you have to like very carefully respond to these enemies' attacks in ways it almost starts to feel a little bit like a Souls-like game, because it also uses experience. This game has a lot in common with Castlevania 2, which was similarly experimental in the way you collect experience and then level up. But then if you die, you lose that experience. So yeah, it has some interesting parallels in the design to some what we'd consider Souls-like games today, especially in the combat and how you're really sort of not quite parrying, but reacting to communicating with these enemies and their movement.
Interesting, yeah. Definitely a title that I haven't given a proper shake to, and I would like to. Did it introduce any elements that were carried on in later Zelda games, you think?
There is the magic meter, basically. Like, you're going through these towns, and you have to talk to everyone because they're all giving you clues to these obtuse puzzles. But you'll find people hiding in, like, every town has an old man hiding in a basement somewhere who will teach you a spell. And you, like, select the spells from a menu. It might be, like, fireball, or increase your defense, or I'm trying to remember. One, like, you turn into a fairy and can float around, and that's, like, a traversal technique. And so it's actually quite, like a lot of customization in how you approach this game and the magic meter there, which I thought was quite clever.
It's a little bit Elder Scrolls, even with the flying abilities, like in Morrowind or something.
Yeah. It was a little too obtuse. I think, like, some of the puzzles were quite tricky to figure out. But it's a really experimental game that I quite enjoyed. It does have the introduction of Dark Link as, like, the final end boss. Incredibly tough. I had to cheese that fight to have any chance of winning it. Most that's pretty much par for the course with these old games, unfortunately. But yeah, I found it really fascinating to study as a weird experiment in game design.
Very cool. All right, let's fast forward on from 1987 into the 1990s, 1991. We're moving on to a whole new platform here, and this is the first time Zelda is not on the original NES system, but we're looking at the Super Nintendo Entertainment System. And this game really ushered in a new era for Zelda, I think, in terms of visuals, anyways. This game, just the addition of more colors, more effects. I think very early on, one of the first scenes has to do with, like, a dark and stormy night or something like that.
Well, the sound design, too. Like, the moment the game starts, and I could tell from just the sound alone that it's raining, that you're inside and it's raining outside. And, like, it was really, really visual, crisp sound design. That, and a lot of the music, too. Obviously, a lot of the classic Zelda songs are introduced in this game. I think I mentioned recently, I have a new appreciation for just what a meteoric leap forward the Super Nintendo was compared to the NES.
Absolutely. Everyone knows that 16 is twice as big as 8. But no, it's really exponentially larger in terms of the millions of colors and the significantly more sophisticated synthesizer chip that was in the Super Nintendo system. And in gameplay terms, you have a much more detailed narrative elements as well.
Actual in-game story and characters.
That's right. Cutscenes, actually quite sophisticated storytelling, even in the first sequence. For its time, yes. But, you know, sophisticated in any case. You know, this would very much align with a lot of, I feel like this is a natural parallel of a lot of storybook titles. And I think that this game kind of fulfills that goal of really being able to tell, like, a Hobbit level story of twists and turns and tension and drama and characters and pathos and emotions. And definitely, like, tension with the changing of the environment, the mood and the lighting. For the first time, you know, you get nighttime versions of scenes and weather-affected versions of scenes and things like that. So this really stood out as a game changer for me. And just, like, the sophisticated, like, play between sort of, I think for the first time, like, there were, like, levels. Like, this, like, level was above that level. You jump down into holes, get into the area below that. Just really sophisticated elements. I think, I don't know if this is one of the first cases where there's, like, that classic puzzle trigger where they have, like, sconces, fire pits, and then you light the fire pits and then they open the doors and things like that.
I think so. It does have a lot of, like, moving statues, like push the statue onto the button, things like that. And that was one of my main takeaways. Like, I don't know how intuitive this would have been if I wasn't already so familiar with the language of Zelda puzzles. I already intuitively knew, oh, I should try pushing everything, right? And they clearly are struggling a lot here to communicate hints. Basically, you have the owl appears here who will, like, or the various characters will talk to you and say, did you understand that? Did you get all that? Or did I do repeat myself? It's starting to introduce more hints in game to remind you of what you need to be doing.
Right. And then in later on, this is fast forwarding quite a bit, but in later on in 3D iterations of Zelda's, the number of elements and entire characters that are there just to remind you of what you should be doing or how things work balloons into many fold. Like, let's just talk about what's that annoying fairy that follows
you. Navi in Ocarina of Time. Everyone loves to make fun of that, but like, we'd all be lost. Let's take it. Like, you'd rather have an in-game contextualized hint rather than having to look up. I mean, I guess you didn't have, you know, you couldn't just look up the guide on your phone back in the day.
Well, you know, to our credit, back in the day, we also may have had a paper guidebook or manual that would
and
have
an infinite time out. To just throw yourself at that wall and try and error your way through it.
That is true. That's early game design for you. Yeah, so A Link to the Past, I never finished it, so it doesn't stand out other than those elements that I told you. Just visually, it looks outstanding. Storytelling is much more intense. Just the world seems deeper. I know that there's, like, moody effects in, like, the... What is it? The mysterious forest with like fog and things like that.
Yeah, like light shining down the sun dappled forest floors and things. Yeah, and like smoke layers and things. It is quite stunning to look at, I would say.
Yeah, and that's what I mean when I say in terms of narratively speaking, this technology is letting the developers and the directors of the games tell much more like cinematic stories, and not just in terms of like showing cutscenes. I'm talking about having more effects at their disposal, even in a really like just theatrical sense of changing the mood through sound, lighting, and visual effects. That's all part and parcel of telling stories. And they were just given more tools to do that. One thing that did also stand out was that really cool pseudo 3D elements right at the beginning when the title sequence...
Oh, the Triforce spinning?
The Triforce elements float in very much 3D polygonally. I'm sure it was all a visual trick, but it felt like, yes, this is a new generation.
Yeah. And it really feels like they've really, like, they just come out running with, like, here's the Zelda formula of that you go to these three dungeons, you get the gems, then you get your Master Sword. Now you've got a bunch more dungeons to go and do. Like, the way that those dungeons and the items are all contextualized as part of this larger story, that overall structure just felt really, this felt much more It felt much stronger here compared to that first game, and they were much more confident and clearer vision of what they want you to do.
They basically tightened all the screws. They made everything that much more succinct and confident, like you say. Was this the first one that introduced the pieces of heart, the four pieces of heart, or was that an earlier?
No, I think that was in the original. Maybe I'm pretty sure that was in the original, yeah.
I feel like in the original you had something like 30 hearts or something, like eventually. They were just very freewheeling with giving out those heart pieces.
I will say, I mean, the puzzles I still did find quite confusing. There was a few times that you have to interact, like you have to sprinkle dust on this random item in order to progress, and I just had no idea. Or you might be given a hint to a puzzle to like play the ocarina to wake up the old man, but you don't need to do that for now. And it's like 2 hours later when I finally need to do that thing, I've forgotten that hint and had to look it up basically. So there's a few times where I hit walls. I still found the combat to be pretty tough in ways that weren't really fun. I found like most of the enemies are really frantic and jumping and bouncing and flying around in really unpredictable, erratic ways. Even just the general knights that sort of charge at you. You have to, like, the way your sword sort of swings sideways and, it, like, the positioning is just really awkward. I didn't find the general movement and combat in this game to be particularly good.
You're not wrong. The combat in Zelda has always been a little bit stilted, especially in the top-down ones, because they didn't have the concept of, I guess, lock-on back then, like they would add in later 3D ones. Okay, let's step forward a little bit further. Not that long of a gap, not 4 years this time, but only 2 years ahead from 1991 until 1993. We're talking about the original Link's Awakening on the original Game Boy, because there were in fact two Link's Awakenings, three now if you really consider it. There was the original Game Boy one, 93, the Link's Awakening DX for Game Boy Color 5 years later in 1998, and eventually the Nintendo Switch remake of Link's Awakening, yet again another remake in 2019, so quite a bit later, almost just over 20 years later. So this game's been remade a lot. Is it the one that has been most remade? Not sure.
Oh, I mean, Ocarina of Time has been remade once or twice, but Yeah, it would probably be Link's Awakening, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I played the original, the DX color version back when I was, you know, 10 years old. This current playthrough, I've played that same version again, largely just to compare to my own nostalgia. I actually did dig up my old Game Boy Color and the cartridge. It still works. Surprisingly, like, I could still save the game. So the battery still seems to be working as well. I didn't want to trust that for an entire playthrough, though, so I just jumped to the Nintendo Switch Online, which I should say has all of these games available on it, and was a fair bit easier to use there.
That's right. So that's a great way to replay some of these older titles. You can gain access to Link's Awakening DX right now on the Switch, like Daniel said. I played it recently on the TrimUI Brick, because I also subscribe to Nintendo Switch Online, so I consider that my license to play this older title. And boy, does it look good. On Game Boy Color, I'm sure it looks much better on these new screens than it did on the original Game Boy Color. I mean, you had it to compare directly. What would you say?
The colors are a little muted by modern standards. They're not really crisp colors. I guess back in playing on the actual Game Boy, you're struggling with there wasn't backlit, right? So you're struggling with trying to play in the light of the street lamps or wherever it is on the back seat of the car. It was quite hard to see these games. They're a little muddy. It doesn't read quite as cleanly as something like Link to the Past.
Right, but I'm still have to remark, and I'm going to be only talking about the DX version, by the way. I don't remember the Game Boy original, even if I might have played it back then. I think the artistry of the pixel art in this game looks fantastic. They make this world look so lush. I think every bit the equal of, almost the equal of, Link to the Past, even on much, much more primitive hardware. I mean, this game was coming out essentially at the same time, being probably developed at the same time by a different internal team at Nintendo, surely. But this game looks amazing. It plays really well. But I feel like they've took some liberties and tried some different things. I feel like the scope of it is different. The breadth of it is different. The world seems more compact and tight, and the design language seems a little bit more focused and rudimentary, perhaps. This game feels very much like adventure gamey. They're just trying to like narrow you down into solving the puzzles, and those are literally puzzles in a lot of cases of find the MacGuffin for this person who had their dog stolen, or find the song, answer to the song, or use the crane game to get the widget or the stuffed animal. It's very much adventure game mechanics left, right, and center in this ultimately 2D top-down kind of platforming game.
When there's the trading quest, like there's a game-long quest in which you're given an item. I can't remember what the first one is.
It's a can of beans or something?
Yeah.
It's a tin can of something.
You have to find the person who wants that, and then they'll give you a banana, and then you have to find the person who wants the banana, and they'll give you a bow tie. And so it's like 12 or 15 of these items over the course of the game, and it's mostly mandatory, but it's sort of trickled out over the course of the game, which it feels very much like a point-and-click adventure trying to sort of follow the trade quest line.
Right. So although contemporary to A Link to the Past, I feel like this game is doing something different with the scope of things, maybe because just like hardware limitations, probably because of hardware limitations. If they could, I'm sure they would have put out a carbon copy or a sister game to A Link to the Past that they had an engine sitting there for. But they had to do something different because this was a purely portable game. This is from a generation when they had purely portable games. And just because you can take the Switch out of the dock doesn't make the games on the Nintendo Switch portable game designs, do they, Daniel?
Yeah, I think they really slow things down. It's a little more of a considered game, partly due to those technical limitations, but like the combat isn't quite as frantic and erratic. It's more sort of considered in how you're approaching enemies. The puzzles are a little more thought out. Like, it's more like the hint system is quite robust here, but there are a lot more puzzles to think through rather than the trial and error of frantic puzzles of some of the older games. So yeah, I think they played into that. And I definitely have my frustrations with this game, but then I think back to we were playing it on portable. Like, one of my main frustrations is a lot of backtracking in this game, both circling back through the world multiple times. You can so many times where you'll find a cave, you'll open it up, you'll get halfway through the cave, oh, there's a block I can't get through because I don't have the item. I have to walk all the way back. So there's a lot of backtracking. It'll let you, you'll hit a lot of walls in this game. But I think maybe when you're playing it on handheld and you're sort of just playing 5 minutes at a time, that frustration doesn't hit so much, perhaps.
Well, our thesis with the beginning of this series was, is Zelda a Metroidvania game? And backtracking is one of the core...
Absolutely.
Core mechanics of a Metroidvania game, utilizing limited resources, game design assets, and the world is a limited asset, to extend the length and breadth and scope of a game design. I think backtracking is very much part of that. And you're right there. You talked about the shorter kind of scope of the puzzles. Basically, if you're having a portable only game, you're really playing 5, 10, 15 minutes at a time. You're not sitting down for 2-3 hour sessions. So you have to keep the scope of the puzzles and the next part of the quest really, really tight. You have those hint givers again. We have, in this case, a very specific character called Alrira, I think his name is.
Yeah, Mr. Alrira, yeah.
Yeah, who's an older gentleman who, interestingly enough, has a little bit of kind of like social phobia, or like he prefers to talk to the world through a phone. There are these landline phones in various places throughout the island. I think one of the Koholint or something like that. The world is very small because you're stuck on an island. That's a convenient excuse there, game developers. Alrira stays at home, but you can call him through the phone. And if you visit his home and talk to him in person, he won't say anything to you.
He just shuts down. Yeah,
yeah, it's very much. It's very much like this character I was talking to you about in Steins Gate, who won't talk to you in person, but she'll text to you anytime. So yeah, the character Alrira is really interesting there. They're not the only character that helps give hints. There's the owl statues, mm-hmm. which we mentioned before. I think there are like some signposts throughout the world, which I guess they introduced in earlier games as well. But there's multiple elements. And of course, just simply the townsfolk. There is a decent-sized town at the beginning of the game where there's lots of kooky characters. Lots of this game is written for comedy's sake, I feel like.
Well, it's quite explicitly and famously inspired by Twin Peaks. And a small town full of weird characters, a lot of dream logic in various ways, a lot of uncanny similarities that you might recognize some of these characters as looking very familiar. Almost, it's very much Through the Looking Glass, or like Wizard of Oz, almost, which also very famously was... utilized a lot by David Lynch, but you'll see people resembling Mario or Yoshi or Princess Peach, as that one monster that's basically Kirby that will attack you. You're running into Goombas regularly. And there's no Zelda in sight, like no Triforce. This is very much in its own little weird bubble dream realm.
Yeah, I think there's one of the dungeons I went into recently, there's literally piranha plants that are coming out of literal
yes.
pipes and tubes. So this game takes a lot of liberty, I guess, with borrowing elements from other Zelda games. I think there's a straight-up Yoshi plushie, if I'm not yes. mistaken, in at least the DX version. And that's a gameplay element where you have to win that Yoshi plushie. And that game I'm talking about specifically is a crane game. So another callback there. So what more can I say about this game, Link's Awakening DX? I'll say that it's a pretty impressive game. First of all, I should say that before I got back into this DX version, I actually borrowed the Link's Awakening Switch version not that long ago from the library. And I think I played the first like 30 minutes of it, and something about that version really rubbed me the wrong way. I don't know what it was. It looks great. Very, very lush design, which we'll talk about a little bit later, from the developer Grezzo, I think they're called. And so it looks great. Everything's kind of like widened out, obviously, for the Nintendo Switch. But something about it just, it feels like wearing a suit that's too big. Everything doesn't sit right, and you feel a little bit uncanny valley about it all. Hmm. Maybe it's some of those uncanny characters and how they're behaving early on at the beginning of the game. But I bounced off of it, essentially. Did you play the Switch
one? I played a few hours of it, I think also getting it from the library. And I don't recall, this is a year or two ago, but I felt it was almost a little too polished in a way. Sort of, it's like zooming in or trying to enhance a small image, and it's something blowing it up to that size. Just you lose something of the charm, I think.
Right, and then blowing up something so large, basically, you don't gain new detail when you enlarge something, right? So basically, you just have a lot of these gaps, and those gaps aren't really filled by depth. Whereas when you play a game on this old platform, everything just fits succinctly. It's like that suit is perfectly tailored to fit you so well. It wears so sharp. It looks so good. And I really, spoiler alert, is the Nintendo Legend of Zelda Link's Awakening DX for the Game Boy Color. I played it on the Trim UI brick. Plays and feels fantastic. It just like looks so good. I don't love everything about it. Like I mentioned, the 2D top-down platforming is terrible. There are actually some side-scrolling platforming sequences in this game, which are...
in the dungeons, yeah.
Quite nice. They're not long or extensive. They're super short.
Yeah, I had my own frustrations with this. Whereas Link to the Past, you'd often get an item in a dungeon and then use it like once. You just use it once to solve something in the dungeon and then never use it again until like 5 hours later you need to like... cross a chasm or something with the hook shot, and like I felt like the items were really underutilized. I think they've overcompensated a little bit here, where just crossing like four screens to get from the town to the castle, you need to get out your feather to jump over this, and then you need to equip your bracelet to lift up this rock, and oh, there's another hole, better get out my feather again and jump over this, and then hook shot over here, and like switching back and forth like half a dozen times. I think there's an early boss that I kept dying and had to repeat, and just getting back to the boss room had to swap back and forth like six times, and that was a bit over top.
I think that's a direct callback to the Zelda 1 though, right? Like you can install different equipment to each of your face buttons.
It wasn't
really
necessary. It was mostly more like combat you were using that for in those older games. It wasn't quite utilized as compulsory puzzles or just navigation really quite so much here. And especially when you've only got two buttons, like obviously on the Game Boy, you're not going to put your sword away. You've got to keep your sword out, right? Yeah. So you really only got one button to switch between everything else. Yeah. I imagine that the remake on the Switch was, I think it had like three or four buttons, so it probably doesn't feel quite as bad there.
Probably, yeah. In a newer system like the Super Nintendo, obviously would have had many more face buttons, the addition of shoulder buttons, so you could have been, you didn't have the annoyance of only being able to carry two items at a time. I agree with you, that element is annoying. There are some fairly cool, innovative things they are doing, though. The map feature is quite robust in this game, including some interactive details. You can highlight over certain elements, and it'll tell you what important feature is on a given square of the map. So a lot of modern Zelda games in 3D don't even do that. So I thought that was a cool element. Another downside to this game is the strange and cumbersome UI. As I recall, you don't have this problem even on the Nintendo Switch with save states, but there's like an awkward key combo that you have to press to even save the game.
Oh yeah, you have to like press every button to bring up the save menu.
Absolutely bizarre. These are the hardware limitations of an old platform like this.
I did do that on my, because when I was playing with my old Game Boy, I had to try and do that to get to the screen save. And it did work, surprisingly. But yeah, I didn't want to risk doing that for the whole game.
Yeah, and of course, there's plenty of people that are coming at this game from playing ROMs on their PC or mobile phone or something like that. And plenty of articles on GameFAQs or something of how the heck do I save this game? Well, there it is.
I wanted to throw in one final point to Link's Awakening. I mean, spoilers for a 30-year-old game, it's all a dream. But curiously, it doesn't use that as a spoiler, as a twist. It like basically halfway through the game has told you, this is all a dream. If you win this game, if you beat the big bad and escape, you're destroying this world. It's going to fade away. And there's this real sense of like this bittersweet melancholy, which I think Ocarina of Time also does really well. And I'm not sure if it's a It reminds me of some of the sort of the Studio Ghibli films, or maybe it's just a more of a broader Japanese aesthetic in these sort of media. But it's real melancholy with how, like, the sense of loss, even though you win, like, you've lost something there.
So you're saying that this is a early crossover with the Apple TV series Severance, then? That is really cool to know. I have another spoiler for you for another multi-decade-year-old game, is that I believe that Super Mario 2 in the US is also just a dream.
That's what I've been meaning to... I really need to put on my retro backlog, too. I never finished that one.
There you go. Neither did I, by the way. Okay. We're just going to fast forward through a lot of games at this point here, so don't be angry with us. It would just take forever and ever to cover some of these games, even ones that we played and loved. Like, we're not going to talk about Ocarina of Time, right?
Yeah, I might come back to that when I finish playing through it with my daughter. I'm really having fun with that right now. But one of my favorite games. Obviously, we've covered that before. Yeah,
maybe I might even finish Majora's Mask, which is a kind of sister game to Ocarina of Time. Anyways, we're going to fast forward that. We've already done Breath of the Wild. So we're going to skip forward to all the way to 2024 to cover a game that I've been playing recently on the Nintendo Switch called The Legend of Zelda Echoes of Wisdom. Interestingly enough, this is the first mainline Zelda game to feature the titular Princess Zelda as the hero, as the protagonist of the game. Link is in there, but Link is in there in very much like as a shadow
sidekick
character. You don't really see him in his true state, but you do see him in a kind of a shadow state on. Link is in there for sure. But really, Zelda is the star of this game. And I think that's actually quite cool. Although, truth be told, in playing this game a lot, I just kind of forget. I'm going to say something that may be controversial here, but I don't think Link is a good character.
I don't think he's not a character at all, really.
Exactly. Link is just an empty shell and is not an interesting character, not an interesting design. I think it's fine. I don't care what Link looked like in any Zelda game, because I don't care about that character one whit. It's fine, whatever they do. Whatever they do with Link is fine, because that character is not a character. They're just a sword carrier. A sword and item carrier. So I don't care that Link is not the star of this game. But I think Zelda's cool, because Zelda is always well designed in all of the games that they put out, and particularly in the newer ones. And in this one, she eventually, there's this intro thing where she gets rescued by Link, but Link falls prey to some sort of spell, and himself is trapped away, and Zelda returns to the world, but the world is kind of turned topsy-turvy, and then there's these kind of like rifts, I think they're called. They're these ominous purpley rifts, which are like big rents or slashes carved into literal space and time. And regular townsfolk in the land of Hyrule are being swallowed up into them. And spoiler for the first 10 minutes of the game, but even important people like the king of the land, Princess Zelda's dad, and some prominent advisors are sucked into the rifts along with Link. So Zelda's on her own for the most part to save the day. She takes on Link's blue mantle, which is quite fetching, this kind of dark blue mantle. And this hides her identity as Princess Zelda, because Zelda may not be on the good side of the law, because basically she was framed. Shadow King said, basically, my daughter has turned evil and is causing these rifts, whereas, of course, the Shadow
King. Did you have a flashback to Link to the Past, where the guards are, like, attacking you because there's wanted signs for Link?
All right, so there's wanted signs for Zelda all over the map. But whenever I see them, I'm like, oh, that's funny. And then I remember, oh, I'm playing Zelda, because I've totally forgotten that I'm even playing Zelda. Anyway, another interesting thing about this game is that it is the second Zelda game by developer Grezzo, which I mentioned before. They are responsible for that what was it called? Link's Awakening remake on the Nintendo Switch. The one that I totally poo-pooed earlier. I feel differently about this game. I think it's a winner. So spoiler alert there. This game looks great. It feels great. The world is much more fleshed out and feels much larger, lived in, much more expansive than even another great mainline entry like Link's Awakening does on Game Boy Color. It just feels bigger. And in very many ways, it feels like a 2D remake of a lot of the more recent 3D Zelda games that we've played. Probably lifting a lot from Ocarina of Time.
Well, I'm thinking more of Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom, and then it's really more of a sandbox.
Yep, I was going to get to that mechanically.
How you want to do that. Like, rather than a prescriptive linear puzzle to solve, it's like, here's a bunch of tools. How do you want to approach this?
I was going to get to that mechanically in a moment, but I'm just talking about the world more at this point. The world is very much like Ocarina of Time in that there is the Goron world. There is the water world.
Zoras.
Yeah. The Zora world. And in this case, there's two clans of Zoras, which is really interesting. And then there's like all multiple corners of the world, and the different peoples live there. I forget who the desert people.
Is it the Sheikah or the Gerudo?
I think. Yeah, you're right. The kind of like a female-led clan of desert folk. So it is very much lifting those elements from those games directly, but with the kind of new kind of 2D cutesy art style, I think it just works really well. I like it. I really like what they've done with this game because, like I said, I'm not too precious about how Zelda looks because Zelda is just a vehicle for puzzles, puzzle adventure in my mind. So let's get to talking about the mechanics, which is what you were starting to talk about. This game is very different from a lot of other Zelda games, a lot of earlier Zelda games, in that it gives you a lot of creative freedom by giving you countless tools at your disposal. Most of the early Zelda games we've been talking about might give you 8 tools, and that like fulfills every puzzle, everything you could possibly do in that entire game.
Whereas most things, you can only use one item to solve it.
That's right. Whereas in this game, you have 8 tools like in the first 20 minutes of the game, and then eventually you'll be having something like 30 or 40 or 50. And by tools, I mean there are multiple things that you can copy in this world, and the technical term for them are echoes. So eventually you're granted this thing called, I think that it's the Wand of Echoes or something like that. Thus, Echoes of Wisdom. You meet this kind of fairy-like companion called Tri, I think. And they are like a fairy and their friends have been captured and you have to rescue the friends. Rescuing the friends will grant Tri more power. Tri has these little tiny Triforce icons which form kind of like a tail or like a ponytail that floats behind them. And that's actually a really cool element, is the more Triforce elements that Tri is able to acquire, the more copies of tools Zelda can spawn within the world.
It's sort of like diegetic interface. It's like the dead cells. Your health is on the back of your character, right?
But
not dead cells. What am I thinking of?
Dead space. You're thinking about dead space. But beyond that, you wouldn't imagine like how different the gameplay space feels between having 4 Triforces and 5 Triforces, because not only can you spawn two power tools, but you can spawn a 2 and a 3 at the same time, or 5 ones.
5 beds.
It's very, very different. Exactly. I'm getting beyond the point. What are those items? They are literal objects like beds,
furniture,
torches, stones, boxes, plants, trampolines. I don't know why trampolines are so numerous in this world. But not only are objects copyable, but every enemy except the bosses are copyable. So when you come to a new part of the world, when you defeat a creature, and you can only defeat a creature early on through the benefit of other echoes, then the first time you defeat them, you can sort of scan them with your wand. And from there on in, you can create copies of that creature, provided you have enough Triforce symbols remaining to sort of power them.
It feels a little like Zelda's a necromancer in Diablo or something, and just summoning minions to go and do her work.
It's really super cool because a lot of those creatures that you spawn, they cannot be directly controlled. They operate off of their own AI. And the one element that you do have at your disposal is you can kind of right trigger to target an enemy. So if there's multiple enemies on the map and multiple creatures that you've spawned, you can target an enemy, and ideally your allies will target that one enemy more closely. Otherwise, they'll behave, operate on their own logic. And I think that part of it is really cool. Eventually, you gain access to a limited time power where you gain the abilities of Link, this kind of Shadow Warrior
That's
power.
Right. Yeah.
And normally you don't have access to a weapon that you can like slash on your own. You can always spin with the wand to destroy the kind of like grass around you. That's not a problem. But if you want to attack something with a sword or hold up a shield or shoot an arrow, you have to expend some of this magical timer energy, which eventually runs out. Like you mentioned in Zelda 2, you have magical kind of timer and fuel that you have to replenish over time. Can't spam it. Anyways. So I found that this type of design was really, really appealing to me, where you weren't given like one answer where like you have to use the bomb or you have to use the hook shot to get across the bridge. You really had to be a lot more creative and experimental with using maybe not even just one tool, but multiple tools in conjunction with each other to defeat a certain enemy, defeat a certain boss, cross a chasm, get up to a cliff, get over burning lava, just overcome all these potential obstacles in your way. Yes, usually it's the bed and the trampoline. I'm not going to lie.
Especially with the interface, like, so I should be clear, I played a few hours of this like 6 months ago, so pretty fuzzy memories, but I seem to recall the interface was a bit fidgety, and just switching back and forth between different items takes some time, so you're probably going to find like a half dozen and just keep to those rather than experimenting and using different things. You're going to find your core staple of enemies and boxes that you want to use.
That is essentially right. It's basically like you're given the entire, instead of having a toolbox, it's like you're given the entire tool shed and you have to sort through them. And it's hard to be very kind of like spontaneous with them. Thankfully, the developers have put a little bit of thought into that. As you say, you can favorite certain tools.
Sort by different means, yeah.
So you can favorite whichever items you want. Maybe it's 40 out of the 50 items you want to favorite. Ideally, it's more like, you know, 4 to 5 to 8 items you want to favorite. And you can right trigger to only see your favorites at any given time. Or you can press, I think it's the Y button to trigger between the most commonly used, the most recently acquired, the least recently acquired, or the last used tools at your disposal. So in combining those elements, the favorites trigger and the sorting trigger, you are able to speed up access to a given tool. And let me just say, a lot of the puzzle designs, some of them are straightforward, but a lot of them are kind of like head-scratchingly fiendish with how they utilize the items at your disposal. And even if you like Zelda puzzles, I think you'll find that this game offers some puzzle design that you've never seen in a Zelda game before. And for that reason, I think it's really, really special. I think this game has some warts, sure. It's not a perfect game, but I really like this style of Zelda's design. And I think I might even like it a little bit more than the larger modern 3D Zeldas. At least I like it more than Tears of the Kingdom. I think the Tears of the Kingdom is a little bit ungainly and would have been a little bit better if the kind of build-a-block tinker toy element was a little bit more constrained, a little bit more focused, a little bit of those magical powers like shooting up through ceilings, a little bit contrived. I like the tight focus of this game, and the scope of the world, the limited scope of the world, allows for that. And I think this game is a winner.
Yeah, playing through these older games, it's really been interesting to see how the puzzle philosophy has changed. And they've really struggled with like communicating what they want the player to do. And they've started leaning on various types of hint systems, and which often just comes down to the game telling you, well, just go and do this. Go to this place and talk to this person, it'll move you forward. Or like, or the you find the owl statue that tells you, okay, just defeat these enemies in this order, and that's the solution. Rather than like intuiting, letting the player figure out a puzzle for themselves, the game just tells you this is the solution. And looking at my notes, I only had like 4 notes for this game, but one of them was that like, it's a very organic way of it seeds these items throughout the world. Like, there's a bunch of trampolines here. I probably need to use the trampolines in some way to solve this. But there is also some flexibility in how you go about it. There might be a few different options with all the items you have. And I mean, I struggled with Tears of the Kingdom 2. I didn't find much satisfaction in like the shrines and things, especially where like making my own solution wasn't satisfying. I would rather have a key curated puzzle solution and try and figure that out. And as you said, I think this is it's pulled back just enough. It's tight, like the because it's not a 3D game. You're sort of locked into this one screen, so it's limited a little more. So even when you are sort of creating your own solution, it feels a little more, a little tighter in how you're going about doing that, rather than just like glitching the physics and brute forcing it.
Yeah, I think that's quite succinctly said. So this is a nod toward the open, creative, wider answers to some of the puzzles that some of the new modern games allowed, but it's tighter in scope. The world is more compact, whereas it still feels alive and well, and I think a very valid Zelda game. I think it reviewed well. Unfortunately, I don't know how well it sold, or I don't know how well in terms of the blogosphere people feel about this game. I doubt that they'll make a sequel. I would absolutely love it if they did. I think this direction of game design really appeals to my type of games that I enjoy puzzle solving. Puzzle adventure games, you know, this game, the platforming is not too tough, but just tough enough. Yeah, I think this is a mark game for sure.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I do mean to get back to it. It wasn't like I do still miss the old days of the curated dungeons and the explicit puzzles to solve. But I did have a lot of fun with this, so I'll have to get back to it sometime.
Great. All right. We covered a lot of Zelda games there. Surely not all. But maybe we'll get back to some of the other great entries in the Zelda series in a future episode.
Yes, yeah, I'm replaying Ocarina of Time right now. A couple of the missing games that I've never played, like the Oracle of Ages and Oracle of Seasons, I've heard mixed things of, but Minish Cap is probably the biggest missing link in my Zelda history. I've heard very good things about that one.
Yeah, I played a little bit of those Game Boy Zeldas, and they are quite a bit fun, and I like how they try things that are a little bit different. Probably Spirit Tracks is the biggest gap.
I didn't love that one.
Just because it seems like the most different, on
a lot of blowing DS. Into your DS to get the train to go.
Sure. All right, I think we should move on. We've talked at length. Let's talk about some non-game topics. You got a dessert topic for us, Daniel.
Yes, for dessert today, my wife has been watching through a bunch of old films, specifically working through the filmography of Billy Wilder, which in turn put her onto working through a lot of old Jack Lemmon films. So this isn't a Billy Wilder film, but does have Jack Lemmon. It is called The Great Race from 1965, directed by Blake Edwards. And many people would recognize this formula, basically. Like it's basically Wacky Races, in that this movie specifically inspired Wacky Races a couple of years later. You've got the great Leslie, played by Tony Curtis, who's like dressed all in white, completely white car, you know, your spotless hero, basically. Also a womanizer, as you'd expect. Bit of a hero that is a bit boring, to be honest. Paired against Professor Fate, played by Jack Lemmon, who's all in black, has like half a dozen different Looney Tunes vehicles that he's using, or like Batman villain vehicles that he's trying to use to blow up the great Leslie, and always blows up in his face, Wile E. Coyote style. It's shot so much like a live action cartoon. They're obviously having a lot of fun with this. It's in the first 10 minutes alone that you go through like so many different like contraptions that are exploding and going awry in various ways. But they are basically having this race from New York to Paris, and like within the first 5 minutes all but those two vehicles are already out of the race, and so the rest of the movie is just those two. It's very episodic, like, oh, now they're going through the Wild West, and it's like they're all dressed in Wild West outfits, and it's a big bar fight. And now they're going through Austria, and there's all this court intrigue going on. So very, very episodic, and where they're all constantly catching up to each other and forgetting all the previous events. Like, there's no much sense of pacing. It's quite a long movie, and it does drag a little bit, but a lot of fun set pieces. There's the longest pie fight scene in cinema history. It goes for like 5 minutes in full Technicolor, as you can imagine. It's a good primal fun. The wild card in this is Natalie Wood, who you might recognize as Maria from West Side Story, you were just discussing last week. And she basically like is a suffragette who is insistent on being part of the race, which and will basically cozy up to whichever racer will let her do so. And so she's basically bouncing back and forth between the other two leads and various tricks and contrivances. But it's a lot of fun. It's not like particularly respectful in how it treats race or women, shall we say. It's par for the course for its time, but it's good slapstick fun.
Very nice. Yeah, I do remember there were the big car race thing. I think there was as a concept, it was really popular back in the day.
Mm. Well, it was just a couple of years prior was It's a Mad, 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 Mad. I think it's Four Mads. Mad, Mad, Mad World, basically, which was more of a screwball comedy where you had the six different groups across the course of the movie. And it was very much the more recent movie, Rat Race, was very much inspired by that.
There was also Cannonball Run, if I'm not mistaken.
Don't know that one.
Okay, I'm pretty sure that's a car race one.
Yeah.
Anyways, that sounds cool. Weird phenomenons from the heyday.
The other fun thing was Columbo, which my wife and I have been obviously watching. Peter Falk shows up as the sidekick of Professor Fate, which basically puts him as the inspiration for Muttley, because Professor Fate obviously is supposed to be is the inspiration for Dick Dastardly in Wacky Races.
Very cool. All right, I'm going to be talking about a couple of quick resources for you to discover music. I have been trying to get back into music. I've talked about that recently. I'm not going to cover my whole like software and hardware routine, which is going to be quite involved, but these are just going to be some quick shout outs. So one thing I wanted to do more is to read more about music criticism, music material, to introduce me to artists and albums that I haven't heard before. And one thing I wanted to intentionally do was to not listen to kind of the typical traditional sources. I wanted to get away from popular music, which is to say, I wanted to get away from a lot of typical American or European, a lot of English language, a lot of white-led bands, legacy bands from music producers that are probably paid too much, and probably artists that have sat on their laurels for too long. And I wanted to listen to genres that I haven't listened to very much. So part of that I did through reading. And this is a magazine. I believe it's print, but I'm reading it digitally through the platform Libby, through my Vancouver Public Library system. So this is called Songlines Magazine. Songlines. It's hard to say. Songline. magazine. And this is specifically about global, it's music reviews and interviews and whatever coverage with a global perspective. And I want to shy away from the concept of world music. I'm putting that in quotes here, because world music has been abused and used and abused in the past to mean basically like very stereotypical, like ethnic music.
Yeah.
And basically there's not a lot of like distinction there. There's not a lot of depth there. There's not a lot of care there, except to bundle foreign sounding
everything bands. Other.
Exactly. This is that weird other stuff that you might not listen to, and it's put together in these comfortable, easy to listen packages, and they're sold on CDs at Starbucks, right? For easy listening or something like that. Putumayo, I think, is a label that comes to mind immediately when I think about world music. Songline magazines.
Peruvian pan flutes.
Yes. Songline magazine is not that. They recognize that the world over, there are musical genres that are not appreciated in the same way that rock and roll and hip hop are. In fact, it's not just about music from over there. This covers music from all continents, even North America and Europe, of genres like folk music, indigenous music, bluegrass, musical styles that are just not hitting the Billboard charts. So I wanted to showcase this magazine because it's really effective that way, and I found quite respectful. And they do like full features on the artists. It doesn't just say, hey, here's some funky drum work. It really digs into their cultural background, intersectionality, because maybe a band might be from the UK, but they might be from a ethnic subculture that has a lot of like immigrant crossover. So such was the case of, I think, the Bombay Bicycle Club, which is a really cool rock band that I discovered that introduces kind of like British like rock sensibilities with like Indian inspired polyrhythm. So that was really cool. This is not a review or anything. I'm just discovering new bands as a result of this. So go listen to check out Songline magazines. Each issue, there is a downloadable digital album that they give you a handful of songs that they might be covering in the magazine. Lots of great stuff if you want to discover more types of music. And it's free on Libby. So go check it out.
Yeah, I mean, I recently mentioned the Unwinnable magazine, which covers, you know, video games and movies, but also included some music coverage, which was all, like, from what little I've encountered of it, was all very sort of niche, personalized recommendations outside of the box. So, yeah, always fun to try something new.
Yeah, personal recommendation and music criticism, I think, is really valuable because I want to fight against the phenomenon of, well, I want to fight against marketing. The algorithm. And I want to fight against the algorithm. I don't want to be force-fed the same tracks that they're trying to pump into everyone else's ears and pretend I discovered it. No, I want to hear human beings' thoughts and opinions and decide for myself whether it's worth adding to my collection. And if you do want to add music to your collection, well, how do you do that? Well, it's hard to get CDs from the world over without spending an arm and a leg. So I discovered a digital platform that allows you to do that for a little bit cheaper. So I'm going to be talking about this platform, which is a little hard to explain, but it's called Qobuz. Q-O-B-U-Z. And apparently they're a French-based company, but their reach is global and their catalog is global. They are a digital store. They are a digital magazine, and they are a streaming service. So you can pay, I think it's like $10 or $11 Canadian a month, and get access to their entire library streaming. And it's also high def music. So a lot of the stuff is like 24-bit, like 48 kilohertz stuff, like higher than CD resolution, high def audio, if you have hardware that supports it. So very much of interest to me with my digital audio player that I got recently. But if you're not into streaming, this service also offers a la carte album purchases. Mm. And its catalog is covering exactly those types of lesser covered genres that I was mentioning, covered in Songlines magazine.
I've seen this recommended by a few other outlets, and my understanding is it's also one of the highest rates of what they pay to their artists for streaming.
That's great. Yeah, Qobuz is mentioned a lot of the times in the same breath as Tidal. Mm. Apparently Tidal is quite good as well and offers high def lossless music, but I read and did a little bit of examination, and I listened to a lot of Japanese pop music, and so me personally, I find that a lot of the Japanese popular artists are on Qobuz, and fewer of them are on Tidal, so that made the difference for me. It may not really affect you. Tidal seems slightly more popular than Qobuz.
Unfortunately, both aren't really compatible with a lot of my devices, like if I'm playing things on the Echo or I guess you could play it through your phone and cast it through there, but it's not quite as compatible with certain devices.
Yeah, phone, PC, there's other platforms, some digital audio players like this will play it. Speaking of magazines, You can also get a free demo, by the way, if you just want to check it out. That's free for a month. That's really good. And Qobuz is also a digital magazine, so you can access their website and freely read some of their articles, where they will cover new releases from a wide range of genres, global artists, underrepresented genres like ambient, jazz, and classical. There's a great depth of jazz and classical in the Qobuz repertoire. And they also have another segment where they do hardware reviews. They cover hardware of high-def audio, so audiophile stuff. So I think just as a resource, they're really, really good. It's either free or cheap. And if my family wasn't addicted to their popular music platform that they're using, I would think about getting a family plan for this. And I'm even thinking about getting a family plan just for myself. Or maybe I'll just buy a la carte stuff. But yeah, cool stuff out there. Qobuz, Qobuz. Go check it out.
Excellent. Well, some great recommendations there. If you have any questions or comments for us, the games we've discussed today, your favorite Zelda game, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
That's right. You can go check out our videos, which we put of every episode on YouTube. If you haven't yet, like and subscribe to us there. If you want to listen to our earlier back catalog of episodes, you can find those only in audio form on podcatchers like Spotify, Apple Music, what have you. And of course, on our website, omnigamers.club.
Does Qobuz do podcasts?
I don't think they do. They haven't delved into that realm, okay. Thankfully. We don't want any more podcast wars, because everything's going wacky with podcasts. We'll talk about that in a future episode. But let's talk about getting in touch with us. So you can reach out to me at markyuasa.bsky.social. How about you, Daniel?
You can find me also at Blue Sky at Board Game Feast and the OmniGamers Club account there as well.
Very cool. Well, anything else to plug before we wrap it up?
TCTC, just around the corner, about a month away now. Looking forward to that. Lots of fun events. I'm trying to figure out whether I can schedule in an RPG. We'll see.
Yeah, I might have a little announcement to make in the future, but my schedule is going to be taken up with not just game playing this time around, so it'll be interesting to see how that goes.
Yes, yeah, looking forward to that. Okay, well, and thank you all for listening, and thank you, Mark, and remember to have a balanced diet of games.
Bye. Bye.